people, welcome to this week's episode of the Montpelier Happy Hour here on WBEW 107.7 LP Brattleboro. I'm your host and producer of the show, Olga Peters, and this is where we talk about how everything in Montpelier shakes out for the rest of us. And I want to welcome mover and shaker herself, Representative Emily Kornheiser, to the show. It's been kind of wild with the holidays and your work schedule up in Montpelier, so we haven't seen each other as much as we normally do. So it's nice to see you, pretty lady.
It's nice to be here with you, Olga, and to be talking about the stuff and how everything in Montpelier shakes out for the rest of us. I am glad to be here. It is early. Anyone who's watching the video version, we are talking early in the morning because we have days full of meetings. So forgive our faces.
Yeah, so if you see us kind of doing this, it's the fact that it's 7:21 in the morning.
Which, you know, maybe you don't think that's early. Who knows?
Well, yeah, the farmers in my family probably don't. I think it's early. So we're going to keep ourselves and everyone else awake with the riveting conversation we have today around school spending, specifically the December 1st letter from the Vermont Commission on Taxes came out. And it's looking at a 5.9% average property bill increase. And of course, if you've been watching the news, the big number that's being floated around, especially by the governor's office and the tax office, to be fair, is that between fiscal year 23 and fiscal year 26, which is the one we're going into, we've seen a 33% increase in property taxes. And one clarity I was wondering if you could help me with, Emily. When they say 33%, they're talking specifically about education taxes. They're not talking about perhaps other taxes, or is that just the education taxes?
Oh, Olga, it is like, it's kind of a weird number, to be honest with you. So the December 1st letter is... in statute, the way it's supposed to be framed, the information that's supposed to be in it. And so we have sort of the same reference points from year to year about what growth looks like, what change looks like in this world that everyone cares about, everyone's invested in, but like very, like the conversation is hard to navigate. This is not a metric that's usually used, that 33% that they used. And what it is it is just property taxes, but it's if you sort of take the sum total of all the property taxes paid in that first year and compared it to the sum total of all property taxes paid in this later year. It's not about like adding up the changes. And so that includes like if new properties have been added to the grand list, all of those taxes would be included. And it's not adjusted for inflation. And so yes, like the sum total of property tax revenue that's been heading into the education fund has changed in that way. But it really doesn't account for like the fact that those years ago, we were like in the height of the pandemic and our property taxes actually went down during that time a little bit because we had all of this other revenue coming into the education fund. It paints one slice of the picture. It's definitely the slice of the picture with the very highest number attached to it. And it's true. That is like one piece of the puzzle that's important to pay attention to. And as I think a lot of folks who pay a lot of attention to this stuff were expecting actually this December 1st letter to predict even higher growth than it did. And
growth
so
in the property tax base?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So like it's the 5.6% growth that's expected, right? 5.9% growth that's expected. People were expecting like double digits again in the December 1st letter. And so I've had a few reporters and a few other people be like, oh, do you feel relieved? I'm like, no, because it's like on top of last year. And last year was more than a lot of people could manage in their budgets. And so The work we have ahead of us is exactly the same. And
Mm-hmm.
whether we're talking about 33%, whether we're talking about 5.9%, the work we have in front of us is that, like, Vermonters' experiences of their property taxes, myself included, maybe you included, is like, this is taking up a larger share of my budget than I'm comfortable with and than I can sustain. And so something has to give. And that's what we're going to try to figure out.
Well, it's thank you for piecing that out, because when I was reading through the letter and I was reading through some of the news reports, that 33%, while I had no doubt that it was accurate, it felt a little bit to me like, gosh, how do I kind of pull this thread? There are facts, and then there are our experiences of those facts and our emotional experiences of facts. And I think for, like you said, a lot of Vermonters are feeling taxes are too high. They've been too high. Vermont has this reputation of being too high in taxes, blah, blah, blah. That story, that 33% felt a little more emotional than it did clarifying. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Or it's
And
being used in an emotional way. Maybe that's the better way to say it.
I think it was used to validate people's experiences. And there are usual metrics that are used in these conversations by technocrats who have these conversations, and this is not one of them. And it doesn't feel kind to say, I feel like someone went looking for the biggest number possible out of the numbers available and put that in the letter. But there's something in there about that, which is, but
Interesting.
like, again, it's a real number that's real, that really happened, that says something about both how our property taxes can fluctuate to fill up a bucket that's re required to be filled by the way we have structured our education system, and how people's property taxes are dependent on all these other revenues that can fluctuate a lot. There's a puppy whimpering a lot near me, and I'm just going to mute for a second while I give them permission to come.
Poor puppy. For our radio listeners, it was kind of cute to watch Emily talk to a puppy with the sound off. Poor puppy. But all four-leggeds are welcome on this show. So if puppy should like to make an appearance, puppy is welcome. So for you, we, last year with the increase being in the double digits and being so stark for so many people, we really dove into it. And I'm wondering for you this year, as head of the House Ways and Means Committee, and as I believe the chair of the Commission on the Future of Public
I
Education.
am not the chair of the Commission on the Future of Public Education, and I'm only the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee for another month. I don't know if I'm going to get reappointed or
That's
not.
true.
Probably will, for better or for worse.
Okay,
But
I'm so sorry. When I was going through some of the
no, it's fine.
agendas
I am
of the
thrilled.
commission.
I'll explain why it was confusing. So the Commission on the Future of Higher Education, of the Future of Public Education, I am not even on. But there is a subcommittee, the Committee on Education Finance,
That
that
must have
is
been what I was seeing.
statutorily required, and I am the chair of that committee.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I was getting nervous when I go through the state's website, because
It's
sometimes its
the
information
AOE's
is.
website is particularly challenging to navigate, I think.
So thank you for clarifying that. But given your work on taxes and given your work with the education tax specifically, what's standing out to you this year? What's new? What's different? Or what is the same that is either positive or negative? All those threads.
What's standing out to me is, one, a lot more people are thinking about this and working on this, and that is fantastic. This is, like, definitely, this is going to take all Vermonters and the whole of state government and every committee in the legislature to do something about it. It's very I know that like people talk about the tax system being complex in a derogatory way. I think sometimes complexity can create equity. I know it makes it hard for transparency, blah, blah, blah. All to say, it's like we're talking about our schools, which are like incredibly disparate and like the management of them and their spend. Anyway, it's a big system. And the more people that are involved in the conversation, the better off we'll be able to understand all the impacts of any possible changes. So I'm excited that all these people are in the conversation, and it seems like a lot more people are ready for change. And that's also very exciting. And I always think of something that you always tell me, Olga, which is you can't control when someone enters the conversation. And so as new people join the conversation, it's really important for us to sort of go back to basics and understand how we got here. And I think one of the important things about understanding how we got here is that it has taken us 30 years to get here in particular. And the assumption that we're going to be able to shift everything on a dime after 30 years of a system developing in all of its challenges and strengths is perhaps just like a little optimistic. And so I'm really trying to like continue to go back to basics over and over again with people. And so I wonder if you don't mind if I do that just for a moment now.
As always, yes, please.
Okay. In the 90s, that's when I first moved here. Most schools all across the country are funded primarily by local property taxes. And I remember where I grew up, there was like huge disparities between the public schools from one town to another, based on grand lists and community will and all kinds of things. It created huge disparities in access to education. Wealthier communities provided higher quality education. And those disparities, that like unbelievably unequal access to educational opportunity, led to lawsuits all across the country. And one of the very first lawsuits to prevail against the state was in Vermont, because of particular language in our constitution. And that was called the Brigham decision. And we have read it on the air. If anyone wants to go into the Wayback Podcast machine, go listen to it. It's actually really pretty fun. And what that meant, we've also read the Vermont Constitution if you want to go find that clause back in the Wayback Podcast machine. And that decision, that Brigham decision about sort of unequal access to education, led to the passage of Act 60, which sought to provide more equitable access to funding across districts. There are many, many ways that the legislature could have decided to solve that problem. They could have decided something that was much more about sort of education and much less about taxes. They decided on something that was much more about taxes. And Act 60 appeared to preserve local control, and it shifted to an incredibly centralized model of the state collection of tax revenues, right? And then redistributing them based on whatever a local district voted on, which is incredible. It's really, and I don't want to get lost in this too much, but in so much of our budgeting in other areas of state government, or even just thinking about like contracted services, it seems absurd that we build our budget based on just sort of like what happened last year or what's available instead of like what Vermonters need, right? And the education fund's the opposite of that. And that's really inspiring that like districts get to say, like, this is what we need to educate our students. Please give us the money, state government. And we do. We raise property taxes sufficient to meet that. And so that is incredible, and it leads to really big challenges in that different districts make very, very different decisions about what taxes they think their community can withstand, even though we're talking about a statewide grand list. And so we still have tremendous inequities in how much districts are spending from district to district based on the culture of communities and the scale that they're operating at means that often very different opportunities can be offered, at the same price per pupil. So that was sort of what took us 30 years, like that all started 30 years ago. We are here. I think it's also important to remember that Take Back Vermont happened. right after Act 60, which was absolutely about cultural issues and gay marriage and civil unions. It was also about property taxes, and local control. And so that's sort of the environment that we are swimming in. Last year, a combination of factors accumulated into what like everyone started calling the perfect storm, which has like become a very boring cliche of a metaphor, but it's now it's just what we say,
People
right?
get it.
And so that was healthcare costs skyrocketed, students need post-pandemic were still surging, even though federal dollars dried up, inflation was up, so like that made heating a building cost more, paper cost more. Schools faced deferred maintenance and crumbling infrastructure because we had not invested in that in a long time. And changes to the formula for counting students reduced tax capacity in some districts and increased it in others, and that caused some inflationary pressures. And we talked about this at the top of the show, the amount of non-property tax revenue going to the education fund returned to sort of similar levels of pre-pandemic. They'd been quite high during the pandemic. And so in some ways we'd been able to sustain increased spending without Vermonters feeling it as directly in their property tax bills. And any one of those single things in a single year would have been a really big deal that we would have spent a lot of time wrestling with. And we knew that a couple of them were coming, and we actually set money aside to prepare for that. The perfect storm we were not prepared for. So last year, the December 1st letter came out right around this time, right? And it projected more than a 20% increase, much panic, and not a lot that's available in the short term. So we worked really hard to reduce the pressures. And we did that by adding a couple new revenue sources. Most new revenue sources are not available in the year that that legislation is passed. And so there's only a few revenue sources that would have made a difference for last year's property taxes. And one of those was short-term rentals. And so like people renting a short-term rental are charged a higher tax right now, things like that. And then we also used one-time money. Like we transferred money from the general fund that could have gone to other things. You know, like mental health care or housing or whatever. We transferred that to the education fund in order to offset property taxes. And so that's what we did for last year. And then we also reinstated something called the excess spending penalty that's was designed to try to control costs this year. Lots of people think that's the reason that the estimate is a much lower growth rate than we were at last year. And we set up this Commission on the Future of Public Education because we knew we needed to do something big. So that brings us to now. That's my little primer. Sorry about that.
No, that's a good one. And it reminded me, Emily, that if folks are looking for other resources, Vermont Public has a video on their website about school funding that I think it was pretty good. And there's
Lola worked
some.
very hard on that, and I also agree. It's very good.
Yes, Lola, thank you. And then also, the Agency of Education just came out with a report. End of November, beginning of December, no, closer to September. Anyway,
No, it was
recently.
November. I was in Nash. It was 2 weeks before Thanksgiving.
Okay, thank you. That looks at Vermont's funding system and compares it to some other states. And there are some explanations in there that I think are also fairly good. Even though I have questions about some other parts of the comparisons, not like, oh, this is bad or the report's bad kind of questions, just like, I'm not sure how this would work. Regardless, there are some good explainers in that report. So I encourage people to check out the Agency of Education's website too. So what's, how do I want to ask this? We'll get into talking about the commission after we hear from some underwriters. So I guess my question is like, what's the next steps? Because, last session at the last biennium, lawmakers really pivoted hard to try to deal with that double digit increase. And there were some things that you were able to do and some things that you weren't. But I think one thing we have known for a long time in Vermont, and was really highlighted with those double digits, is there are some systemic things in our school systems and in our funding system that just need to be looked at. And so, what are those threads? Are there some systemic things at this point that have come to light, or will we not know that until the commission goes through, a good year or so of work?
Well, Olga, you said you wanted to talk about the commission after the break, so now I don't know what to do.
Oh, okay. I have stumped Emily. Well, I
I
guess.
guess what I would say is, we know that we need to make short-term solutions available for this year, and we know that this year we need to set in motion long-term sustainable systemic changes. And the way we are figuring out what is on the table, what policies we need to be looking at, is through the commission and the finance subcommittee. And the thing that has come the most strongly to light in all of that, and then again, we can talk about that more after the break, is, and I don't want to say like this is a new epiphany, but like it's been really like very solidified, and there's a lot of agreement on this, is that like no one thing is going to make a difference on this. There's no one, Maura Collins, who's like one of our, regular guests here, does this fiscal briefing for the legislature once a year. And she always does this fun game where she like sets up one of those like polls that you do on your phone, or she has people vote with their hands about like, what do you think is like the biggest reason that we don't have, what do you think is the reason that like we have a housing shortage? And everyone gets like really into their reason. And then she's like, it's everything, people. And like everyone falls for it every time. It's pretty fun. And the public education system is exactly the same. Like there are significant changes and challenges in how we deliver public education in Vermont that are based on like 100 years of evolution and need some significant zhuzhing. And then there's a lot about our tax system that really reinforces some of the negative behaviors of the delivery system. And
Interesting.
so the way those two things interact with each other means that significant changes are going to be need to be made in both. And some of those are like little tweaks, but without that little tweak, the big thing won't work. And so that's what we're sort of going to be picking up as the year begins.
Okay. We have about 5 minutes left before we hear from some underwriters. So I hope this isn't opening a can of worms, but one question that keeps coming up to me is the other big education change we made was with Act 46, and school governance and that sort of thing. In some ways, I'm wondering, was it successful? Is there still more work to do around, like, did Act 46 help where we are? Like, it was
Yeah.
such a big change for so many people that.
So there have been a number of times we have made changes to our education system in the last 30 years. There was Act 68, which came a few years after Act 60. There was Act 46. There was Act 173 that really completely changed how we deliver special education services. There was Act 127 that changed how we counted students. And all of them, because they were done in isolation from all of the other pieces, and because the legislative process is messy and compromises begin to be built in order to get to agreement, somewhat fell short of their goals. And so Act 46 is a great example of that, in that it changed governance. It did not change delivery, right? And one of the pieces of that is that in changing governance, if money was saved in that those governance changes, because of the way the tax structure works, that money that was saved went usually directly back to that district to be spent for other stuff, which is great. I just don't know if that's what people intended, right? And I wasn't in the, I wasn't in the legislature when Act 46 passed, thankfully. Grateful for that. But all of the, and that's sort of like there's, I could tell you a similar story about 173 about why it, I mean, similar but different. And so I feel when we think about the work that we need to do over the next few years, thinking about how we can be really controlling for unintended consequences or for how we create incentives in the system that might not be the incentives we want. And what are we going to do through the political process? Because when I look at sort of this suite of policies that have been discussed at the commission and the subcommittee, what becomes clear is that if we put them all in one package, any one community is going to like love 4 out of 10 and hate 6 out of 10. And it's going to be different which which communities hate which, right? And does that mean that everyone can say, I understand that if we can compromise on these 4 things we don't like or these 6 things we don't like, it will be for the good of Vermont, and we know that our school will in the end be better and our property taxes will go down? Can everyone like get around that? I don't know.
Well, and can they get around it after decades of feeling frustrated and let down
Yes.
by many of these pieces of legislation, for better or
Yeah,
for
and by the
worse?
legislature, by the, the trust with the legislature is very low, trust with the agency of education is very low. It's all, yeah, it is tough stuff. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Emily. We're going to hear from some underwriters here on WVEW LP Brattleboro. But before we go, I want to just leave listeners with this thought. We are hoping to have folks from the Vermont Historical Society back on the show in the coming months to go through some different pieces of history and hopefully apply some context to some of the things that we are struggling with now. In part of that preparation, I was reading through a few speeches from governors, both inaugural speeches and speeches they gave as they were leaving office. And a theme that came up in several of them that I'm just sitting with, especially given the recent election, were these governors talking about institutions and how we need strong institutions in Vermont and how we need particularly strong education. Because for these governors, these speeches were all from about the 1800s, summer, just around the Civil War era. And they were talking about why these things were important was because part of their duties, that as I read it, as lawmakers, was to make sure that there was a healthy government and a healthy democracy to pass on to future generations. Like that was part of their duties. And so I'm just sitting with that and sitting with that bigger context of, again, what Vermont do we want to live in? And what do we want Vermont to be? And some of these really messy, nitty-gritty things like education funding is actually a really big part of that.
I've been thinking about that a lot myself, thinking about what it means for a school to be the only strong institution in the community, what it means for schools to be strong institutions in communities where very few children live. What it means for all that pressure to be on those kids, and how, even on like the sort of basics of macroeconomics, and sort of community development, strong institutions like schools actually stabilize local economies in really profound ways, right? With just like having a bunch of people who have regular jobs with steady salaries and steady benefits, right? And so, like, all of those things are good for everyone. And if we have property taxes that are unsustainable for folks to fund those institutions, faith in those institutions will wane, right? And so what I was so struck with when I was knocking on doors was when I was ta I talked to a lot of retired teachers about this.
Interesting.
And part of it is just like, they still are in sort of regular contact with the NEA and still get a lot of sort of messaging from them. And so they're more tuned into the nuance of the conversation. And they're on a fixed income, right? And the education fund pays for the pension system. So they like are living a very extreme sort of crux of the problem, right? And they don't feel like it's okay, that like what's happening right now is okay. And so I feel like if the retired teachers are like, oh my God, you have to do something about this, then that's like that feels to me like a canary in the coal mine, right? Because I think most people would assume that like retired teachers would go vote yes on school budgets for the most part, right? And so that's what we're going to need to work with. But it's really like each of these localized conversations, I think, really comes from a place where most people really do understand the profound value to their schools, right? Woodstock had a school board meeting the other day, and in order to keep their taxes lower, they're planning on cutting a bunch of arts programs. And that's bad for kids. And so everyone's like, state, fix this so that we can all have all the things.
Yeah, so we can have nice things too.
And that's, yeah, it's hard because it needs to be all of us, right?
Exactly. So hang tight, folks. Emily and I will be right back after we hear from some underwriters. Welcome back to the second half of the Montpelier Happy Hour here on WVEW LP Brattleboro. So glad you can join us. If you are just joining us, I'm the host and producer, Olga Peters, and I'm speaking with regular contributor, Representative Emily Kornheiser from Brattleboro. We are talking education financing and want to quickly do some housekeeping. Thank you, BCTV, for taking the video version of this show and sharing it with stations around Vermont. And Emily, what do we remind listeners of?
Olga, the views and opinions expressed here on the Montpelier Happy Hour are those of the host and the guests, respectively, and not the station, nor platform, nor employers or friends of the person speaking.
Why, thank you.
Welcome.
Just a housekeeping note for folks too. We went a little over time in the first half, so if this second half feels short, that's why. And Emily, so let's talk about going forward. We know our financing system for education has its issues. We know a lot of schools and communities are struggling with property taxes. In many ways, this is not new news. The Commission on the Future of Public Education in Vermont is, however, fairly new. So let's quickly just give people a touchstone on what the commission is hoping to do and how it's planning to do it.
So the commission had an interim report that is due on December 15th, and that report was really driven by the work of the Education Finance Subcommittee. And what that's going to look like is a very well-organized and comprehensive laundry list of possibilities of what could be done for education and what it might look like to think about those things. They're not going to be recommendations, they're going to be considerations. And
Just a place
then
so people have a starting point,
a
basically, is
starting
what it
point,
sounds like.
yes. Like a starting point that's informed by all of these folks who know so much about our education system. And then from there, we will, the commission itself is going to continue really working on the rest of its charge, which is like, how do we actually run this wild system? So they have a bunch of charges sort of separate from the issue of property taxes and delivery. The recommendation the considerations are there's more than 20 of them. And so I've been like really struggling with how to talk about them in a way that's interesting to anyone. And so I'm going to give it a go right here. How's that sound?
That sounds great.
Okay.
You get a
So
sneak preview, folks.
sneak preview. So there's one sort of cluster of recommendations that is about sort of effective and efficient delivery. So it's things like class sizes, school sizes, district sizes. With a lot of us, the folks who think that's a good idea, that we need to be really sort of focusing on larger class sizes, larger school sizes, larger district sizes, are looking at evidence, national evidence, that all three of those things lead to better opportunities and better outcomes for kids. And a lot of teachers actually talk about how sort of larger class sizes are easier for them to provide a more quality education, which I think is interesting. Because it feels a little counterintuitive if you're not a teacher, which I am not. And there's sort of a lot still to be decided about how that might be applied differently in a rural versus urban environment. A lot to be decided about, this ongoing Vermont question about like geographic necessity and how, like, when that is real and when it is a political construct. And what is the appropriate size and scale in Vermont? What we have right now are not small schools, they're actually micro schools. And so what we call a large school here would be considered a small school, like anywhere else in the country, even incredibly rural places. And so what like a shift like that would look like and what's appropriate and clearly what's appropriate for a kindergartner is different than what's appropriate for a 12th grader. And then in that, it's how do things like pre-kindergarten fit in? How do things like career technical education, early college, how do all of those things fit in? Because they really do impact the scale of the building and the infrastructure. And they also impact the number of kids in classrooms. And right now, our system is really incentivized and disincentivized in really weird ways around what schools offer pre-K, what schools and how much pre-K they offer, whether or not kids attend a career technical education system, what happens to kids who do early college or dual enrollment. And so, like, that's all sort of part of that big conversation. Then there's a whole big cluster of work around support services, we'll call it. That's special education, mental health care. And so, in that system, are we delivering services in a way that kids are getting their needs met? And what is the balance between contracting services and delivering those services in-house, delivering those services by trained professionals who might need to be paid more versus lesser trained paraeducators who are sort of like behavioral managers in seats, but there might be so many of them that they actually wind up costing the system more. There's a lot of evidence that what we're doing now is not working at all. And we passed Act 173 to change that. In the special education context, and we haven't changed it yet. And there's a lot of federal requirements that are woven into that that need to be taken into consideration. So that's like that whole chunk. And special education and mental health are different. They just have some similar challenging dynamics in terms of shifting the landscape.
Well, and it probably is worth noting too that when you're taking care of children, you're also taking care of families, and some of these services also have to serve families as well. And I can imagine in some rural, very rural areas, the school is the one institution that could deliver some of these wider services.
Yes, and we have a really great model, a federal model, in something called community schools that is being piloted in Vermont. And so that's sort of part of that conversation too. And one of the reasons this costs so much is partly because of our like labor force scarcity issue, is one of the reasons that the mental health care system is so fragile right now. But also, over the last 30 years, the delivery of sort of human services work has been really slowly devolved, like from the feds to the state to municipalities and then to schools as sort of the last stop of people who are picking up the pieces. And
Interesting.
that's one of the challenges there. So, okay. So I have two big chunks of stuff. The next one, and we're still in the education delivery slice. There's also a whole tax slice that we'll get to. So the next slice of stuff is things the Agency of Education have done in the past, might not be doing now, or could do and do in other states that would make administrative services way more efficient and effective, right? So that's stuff like curriculum standards and curriculum templates and best practices and like way wide bulk purchasing, like way wider dissemination of all kinds of things from like a top down in order to serve, up model. Because right now, for the most part, every district is going at it alone and like reinventing each wheel. So that's a whole slice of stuff. And then there's like the facilities question, right? And so, like, what are our facilities? Are they serving kids the way they need to? Are they set up the need to? Really ties into the changes in class sizes, school sizes conversation, right? All of that infrastructure, infrastructure, infrastructure. So that's like, those are all the things that likely need to be changed in our education system in order to really make a difference, in order to make our schools better and save money. And that's kind of magical that like maybe we could actually do both of those things at once.
You know, what you just gave for examples makes me think about my friend who. This example won't hold up exactly now because it was from pre-universal meals, but she was a school secretary, and it was her job to put together bills for school meals. So again, before universal meals. And so she'd have to go through and see like who qualified for subsidized food, who didn't, who'd been paying, who didn't, you know. So it was a big job in of itself. But the part that always stood out for me is she collated this information on behalf of like three different elementary schools. And one of the things that always took her forever was that nobody was using the same spreadsheet. And so nobody was collecting the same information and outputting the same information. So before she even started, she had to like take these three different spreadsheets and make them work together before she could start sending bills to families who still needed to pay for school lunch. And it was so much wasted time on her part.
And so it's an enormous amount of wasted time on her part. It's likely that the amount of time she was paid is less than they ever actually brought in on school meals. More. Like her
Yeah, the
position shouldn't have
amount
been,
they
right?
paid
Yes.
her was
Yes.
probably, yes.
More than they ever brought in school meals. But also the amount of wasted time with all of those offices creating their own spreadsheets, right? So, yes, that is one of the many, many things like that. And then there's also the slice of like how we deliver benefits to teachers, right? Like salaries are the salaries and benefits and school employees. Like that's one of the biggest pieces of the pie. And so healthcare costs are skyrocketing. Is there something we can do about that? In just this context, maybe, maybe not. And then pension costs also are sort of a part of the education fund. So how does that work? Okay. Those are all, that's like the big sweep of education stuff. There's a lot more to be said. And one of the things the commission's gonna be taking on is like the role of the Board of Education in all of this stuff versus the Agency of Education, where our education quality standards fit in, what enforcing anything means, all of that. Okay. Federal reporting. I didn't even talk about that. Okay.
Yeah, that's a whole other
So,
layer.
yeah. And then in tax land, we have a fun lineup of stuff, which includes a whole bunch of people want to add more money to the education fund. And their ideas around that are things like expanding sales tax to services, like taxing legal services, for instance. Or taxing, creating a new tax bracket for the wealthiest Vermonters, right? And putting that into the education fund. Except like taxing services is really complicated because it's very unclear what a service is or isn't. Unless you do it really carefully, it winds up being a pink tax because women tend to access services more than men do. The idea of levying a tax on every accountant and attorney in the state and having them all descend on me to argue against it is very unappealing.
Yeah, I can see why that
Like
does
they're
not
very
sound like
organized,
fun.
but like they're like skilled lobbyists. And so there's sort of like that slice of things, and sort of that are being brainstormed and considered. And then there's another slice of things that are under the title, and this is something that like local school boards talk about a lot, is like moving non-education costs out of the education fund and into the general fund.
Such
And
as.
everyone has a different definition of what is an education cost.
There you go.
Very much such different ones. And one of the things that one, there are some interesting dynamics to this. One is that like it's not like the general fund is flush with money right now, right? And so the amount of sort of economic constricting or financial constricting that would happen with anything in the general fund if it was moved there, I think the reality of that might be sort of hard to unpalatable for districts when it came down to it. There's also this wild thing with federal issues in that school districts are required to deliver certain services to students by the federal government. And so if something has moved, so one great example of this for me is mental health services. So we pay for a lot, most of our mental health services stuff is paid for out of the general fund, like our designated agencies, right? And the designated agencies aren't necessarily doing as much as the school districts need them to in order to meet requirements of 504s, which are contracts with parents that are regulated by the feds, right? And so the districts hire within their budgets to cover that difference, right? And so we are paying for that out of the general fund. We consider it a general fund cost, but the school districts are still making up the difference. And so that's like one of those, that's one example of how complicated that would be to do. But it's one of the big ideas. And I'm trying to really paint the complication of each of the big ideas in order to just help folks get a sense of like how gnarly this is. Not that it's impossible, just that every single piece comes with really big trade-offs that we need to be considering as we move forward.
And I think to put it another way, it's so simple to stand on the outside and say, well, just do this. Or what I hear at a lot of meetings is, well, when I was in school, da 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 da, we didn't have da 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 da. And it's like, well, of course you didn't have computers. They hadn't been invented yet. And so it's not a simple, oh, just do this.
Yeah, exactly. And so another, let's see, another big category from there is changing just like who pays and how property taxes. So that's things like changing the common level of appraisal stuff, changing the property tax credit, things like that. And you could, and then sort of similar in that bucket is things that cost the education fund money that maybe shouldn't. So that is current use. That is TIFs, tax increment financing districts. So there's a bunch of ways that we adjust the property values. Taxing churches, I don't know. There's a whole bunch of ways that we adjust the property values that you could think of as costing the education fund money. You could think of it as just appropriately valuing those properties. Up for debate, one of the pieces of the puzzle. And then the last category is like taking the whole property tax thing apart and putting it back together. Oh, I forgot also in the new revenue is taxing second homes differently than regular homes, right? So that's new revenue, possibly, or just changing the ratio of how people pay property taxes. Okay, last category is like we change this whole thing. One of the challenges that we saw with Act 46 or Act 173 is we figured out ways, we put forward ways that we thought were going to save the system money that would essentially sort of force quality efficiencies, quality and efficiency in school systems. But what we saw was that districts that had a propensity to pass budgets and spend tended to pick up that slack and put it in something else, and districts that didn't. And so that sort of widened the gap further between haves and have-nots. What would it look like if we said to districts, actually, this is how much money you get to spend per weighted pupil in your district, and we will raise money sufficient to do that. But we can't have these huge changes from district to district in how much we're spending. And in order for that to work, we would need to do all that stuff sort of above the line, right? Like we would need to do all those things that make it easier to actually run a school. Because some schools are like sort of at their peak efficiency and effectiveness, and some aren't. And that's mostly accidents of history and like having the right leader at the right time, having the right buildings at the right time, right? Not anything like, it's not anything that we can control today. And so we need to compensate for it. And so that's the great big swath of things. And that entire list that I just recited for the boredom of all of our listeners, very, very few of those things will make any difference on this year's property taxes. And so likely we will, the conversation that we're having is about transferring money again from the general fund to cover the difference the way we did last year in order to sort of buy ourselves more time for these big systemic changes. Not buy ourselves time to pass these systemic changes, just buying ourselves time for them to take effect.
Well, because one of the things you don't want people to do is to make systemic changes in the throes of panic or the throes of not understanding something,
No.
reactive changes rather than
And every one
actual
of these
fixes.
changes takes like a pretty decent amount of modeling to see what would the impacts be. And the Agency of Education, their access to quality data is really very, very low right now. They've been quite hollowed out over the last few years, and they are trying to rebuild their data infrastructure, but it is a slog. And so they're real like, one of the challenges with the Commission on the Future of Public Education is they have not had the data yet that they needed in order to make recommendations, which is one of the reasons they haven't.
You have mentioned that before about sometimes in Vermont when we need to make decisions, we actually haven't been collecting the data or had the capacity to collect the data that could actually help us make decisions.
It's one of my top three legislative themes, Olga. It's why everyone loves me so much, because I am just filled with pep and hope.
For data.
Yeah. Like a very electable quality. A deep love of data.
Yeah, in a world where nobody cares about until they see their own tax bill go down. Well, on that note, I know you need to get to another meeting, and so we should probably wrap up. Any thoughts for listeners as we head out to keep an eye on or public engagement opportunities?
Oh, thank you. So the Commission on the Future of Public Education actually is doing like very comprehensive public conversations in every county in the state. They have not come to Windham County yet. I think they've been to three counties so far. And so they're continuing those. People should look out for that. You can tune into any of these meetings I'm telling you about. It's like a Teams link or a Teams recording on the AOE website. Olga, you can link to that if you want. It's a lot. And folks should stay tuned for this interim report from the commission, which will be out on December 15th.
Looking forward to that. And in
Yeah.
the meantime, Emily, how can people find you?
Folks can go to emilykornheiser.org and you'll find links to all my social media, sign up for my newsletter, stay connected.
Fantastic. Well, thank you. And as always, you can find the Montpelier Happy Hour on WVEW LP Brattleboro every Friday at 2 p.m., rebroadcasted on Wednesday mornings, and of course, BCTV and wherever you subscribe to your podcasts. Thanks so much, everyone, and take care. Have a good weekend.